So Dr. Anthony B. Pinn is a professor, author, and public intellectual working at the intersections of African-American religion, constructive theology, and humanist thought. Pinn is the Agnes Cullen Arnold Professor of Humanities and Professor of Religious Studies at Rice University. He's also the founder and executive director of the Center for Engaged Research and Collaborative Learning in Houston, Texas, and director of research for the Institute of Humanist Studies in Washington, D.C. He earned his PhD in the study of religion at Harvard University in 1994. Here is Humanism and the Challenge of Race with Anthony B. Pinn.
Good afternoon. I'm delighted to be here with you. I wish I could stay longer, but this trip it isn't possible. You should know the Midwest has a special place for me. It's a special geography. I spent 10 years of my life in Minnesota, in St. Paul, Minneapolis. And it was special in part because I was at McAllister College and it was just a great environment for me. But more important than that, it was the place where my personal humanism connected to communities and organizations. I began to think about myself as a humanist in very different ways. I'd spent 25 years of my life in the African Methodist Episcopal Church. It's the oldest black denomination in the United States. By the time I enrolled in college, I was ordained. By the time I finished and was headed to seminary, I was Reverend Anthony B. Pinn. I could marry, bury, and baptize. I could do it all. Deeply interested in this thing, trying to figure this out, trying to make sense of ministry. And I thought about ministry along the lines of Adam Clayton Powell Jr. Maybe you know him, maybe you don't. But he pastored a really significant church in New York, Abyssinian Baptist Church. And he had a ministry that was earthy. It was grounded. For him, the church entailed an opportunity. That it wasn't so much for him about the theology, but it was about what that institution could do to transform the lives of those around it. And for him, it wasn't how many people came and accepted Jesus Christ as their personal savior, it's how many black folks he could get employed in Harlem. And for me, this made a tremendous amount of sense. And I tried to move along those lines, but it reached a point where even that more earthy social gospel type of ministry did not work. That I was answering questions that people weren't asking and condemning them to hell for asking questions that I just didn't want to deal with. I had learned that you spiritualize everything. It's about demonic forces. You wrestle not against flesh and blood, but powers and principalities. It's the stuff that you cannot see that is really doing you in. And I was trying, even with a liberal ministry, I was moving people in that direction. It reached a point where it just did not make sense to me. I left New York, where I was an undergraduate, and moved to Cambridge, Massachusetts to do more advanced work, and it reached a point in dealing with people where I had to make a decision. Either I was going to help to preserve the tradition, regardless of its failings, or I was going to be about the business of trying to say something to human misery. So I left the church, surrendered my ordination, and with time called myself a humanist. Now, so my life divides fairly evenly between two developments. My life within the context of the church as Reverend Pinn, and then my life as a humanist. And oddly enough, they are connected in a rather profound way. Whether I was the minister fighting demons or the humanist championing logic, I remained a black man living in a country that treats blackness with suspicion, at best. That remained consistent. And in thinking through that, as an undergraduate and then as a graduate student, I read someone who I think the world of, who remains one of my favorite authors, W.E.B. Du Bois. As an undergraduate, I'd been assigned Souls of Black Folk, but I was an undergraduate reading Souls of Black Folk, and it was about getting through it as quickly as possible rather than absorbing it. So the little the pieces of music at the top of each chapter, this was good for me because it meant less I had to read on that page. Right? So I was moving as quickly as I could. But then as a graduate student, I read it anew. And it made a tremendous amount of sense. And I discovered something people in ministry did not tell me, and my instructors as an undergrad did not tell me. Despite the fact that W.E.B. Du Bois addresses in some of his writing the Black church, he was a non-theist. And Dusk of Dawn, he argues, look, his family lost any substantial touch with the Christian church before he left Massachusetts heading to Fisk. And by the time he studied in Berlin, it was all gone. He was like us. Major figure in the development of sociology, wrote one of the most important historical treatments of period of slavery in the United States, first African American to graduate from Harvard University with a PhD, worked with William James, outstanding figure. But this book, Souls of Black Folk, it's haunting because in 1903, better than 100 years ago, he frames the question of race in a way that still plagues us. We've not moved beyond the state of race relations that he knew in 1903. In that book, he frames, in the language of his day, the Negro problem. And in the book, he argues that you can address this Negro problem coming out of the Civil War and Reconstruction in a variety of ways. And so one, he argues for education, but not Booker T. Washington technical education, but a broad liberal arts education that will allow folks to critically engage the world and develop effective communication strategies to own their existence and articulate that existence. A range of tools with which to approach the world. He champions this, but in the book recognizes that even this falls short. Economic opportunity. Give African Americans an opportunity to participate in the economic life of the United States and things will change. How can you despise a population that helps make the nation wealthy? This fails. Religion. It says, what about religion? Perhaps independent Black churches, the only institution in Black communities not economically or ideologically indebted to secular white America, Black churches. He said, well, maybe this is the answer. Black churches fail. Every strategy he names fails. And W.E.B. Du Bois, early in the book, recognizes that this fails because there's a more tenacious disregard, a more tenacious understanding of race that has little to do with the socioeconomic and political life of the nation. It has to do with a psychic disregard. And he names that issue this way. How does it feel to be a problem? He's speaking to Blacks in the United States. How does it feel to be a problem? And he argues that, you know, it's okay. White folks really don't ask this question, right? They don't ask this question. They have polite conversation that skirts this issue. And he says it's all right because he really doesn't have an answer to that question after all. But that is the nagging issue, a psychic disregard that is premised not upon logic and reason, but gut knowledge. You don't have to go to school for this. It's just a kind of gut knowledge. I'll give you an example of how this works. Perhaps you know the figure Howard Thurman. Maybe, maybe not. Howard Thurman is a great African-American churchman. He is a significant theological figure taught at Boston University. And this story from his childhood is what captures me. He's getting ready to go to college and he's trying to save money, trying to get money together, right? Trying to get money together. And he's doing odd jobs in order to make this happen. One of the jobs involves waking up the leaves in the yard of one of his neighbors. And this neighbor has a young daughter who thinks it's rather funny to kick the leaves around after he has straightened it up. And he's about the business of trying to get this money together to go to school because he knows college education breaks certain shackles. So enough with the foolishness. She does it once. He sweeps it up. She does it again. He sweeps it up. Third time says, hey, you do it again, I'm telling your father. And she looks at him like, no, you did not. Pulls a pin and jabs him in the hand. And Howard Thurman jerks back, ah. And she looks at him baffled and says, that didn't hurt. A kind of gut knowledge that produces a certain type of racial disregard. Du Bois taught us this in 1903, and yet we continue to struggle with it. And so what we encounter in 2018 is not new. The form of this racial disregard is a bit more aggressive and outspoken than we might be used to. But the nature of race and race relations in the United States have not radically changed. And so we were disappointed. We had a president, President Obama, and we thought, this is it. Everything has changed, right? We are a different country now, very different place. But the kind of disregard that surfaces, it's a disregard that can be deadly. Even trying to catch your breath can result in your demise. It did not change. And so as humanists, as free thinkers, as it becomes rather easy to point fingers and say, well, so much of this, if not all of this, is the result of religious fools who believe nonsense and as a result strangle our democratic process, right? And so we point the finger at the evangelicals. That's an easy target. And we assume that it's the religious folks who are accountable and responsible for what is happening, that this is their problem. If we could just rid the country of religion, we would not have these issues. And in saying that, we fail to recognize a couple of things. Key within that is there is a legacy of racial disregard and violence that is attached to free thought as well. If you claim Thomas Jefferson, you claim this legacy. Racial disregard and sexual violence. And so rather than simply pointing the finger at the religious, we might want to look at ourselves and ask the question, what is it about our collective life together? What is it about our social arrangements that tends to produce this sort of disregard for the other? Secondly, we need a more complex and nuanced understanding of how religion has functioned. And so I wish I had a dollar for every time someone asked me, why do black people who've been oppressed by Christianity continue to embrace it? Just a dollar for every time I was asked that question. I could buy some good stuff with that. Now, it's true that there are ways in which African Americans and other populations have been duped by Christianity. They've been encouraged to take their eye off of what takes place within the context of historical arrangements and look to the by and by. This is true, and some segments of the population have fallen, but you cannot explain Denmark Vesey, Gabriel Prosser, Nat Turner through that perception of religion. These were dudes, ordained ministers, who said they were called by God, who also argued that freedom is the key. And if securing freedom means the death of white people, then white people will have to die. There is no passivity in that statement. Or how do you explain Adam Clayton Powell Jr.? Or how do you explain a Jerina Lee or a Martin Luther King Jr. if you simply argue that religion is for fools and it offers us nothing productive? Now, I would say this, in the same way that it's difficult to run a marathon on a candy bar, you really can't secure the kind of sustainable justice we're interested in through a theistic orientation. It just misses the point. But to simply dismiss it out of hand, and why would black folks do this? When the question we ought to be asking is this, why hasn't humanism appealed to these communities? How has humanism fallen short? Why isn't it more attractive? With the growing number of African Americans and others who say enough of Islam, enough of Christianity, enough of these traditions, why hasn't this been more appealing? And it seems to me that perhaps it hasn't been appealing because we haven't gone about this properly, in part because our posture towards the work of social justice has been a bit off. And so I want to quickly go through a couple of things that we should probably stop doing, and then we can chat a bit. Yeah? That'll work? Okay. First, maybe this is a personal preference, but I don't like this phrase, people of color, because it fails to recognize something. It assumes that white people are not raced, that it's white people as the norm and then everybody else. People of color, white people. When the truth is this, a sense of whiteness is dependent upon a sense of blackness. Whiteness is understood over against blackness. This has been the case for hundreds of years. To understand whiteness, one must have blackness. They are intimately connected. Here's the truth. Everybody is raced. In recognizing that, we're also able to move beyond the norm, right? So we move beyond the strategy of the melting pot, which is really code for they will be more like us, us being white people. Right? We'll blend together, but we remain normative. It allows us to short circuit this by kind of recognizing how every group is harmed by restricted categories of race that determine how we get to occupy time and space. Everybody is raced. And so rather than talking about people of color, we might want to say people of a despised color. Recognizing that race impacts everyone. There isn't a lot of Martin Luther King's theology that I embrace, but there's an idea that Martin Luther King Jr. had that I think has some merit. He argues that there's more than one way for a group to be harmed by race. One can be harmed by the effects of race that cause us to think too little of ourselves. But we can also be harmed by categories of race when we think too highly of ourselves. Recognizing that we are all raced allows us to kind of rethink the playing field and recognize that social justice work regarding race benefits everybody. I think it's also important to rethink strategies. Theists tend to be extremely optimistic when it comes to struggle within the context of the world because they understand themselves to not be wrestling alone. There are divine powers that are assisting them. God is on the throne and all is well. And so they are hyper-optimistic. So you can get a Martin Luther King Jr. arguing, the arc of the moral universe is long, but it bends towards justice. There's a certainty for him, delusional, I would argue, but a certainty for him based upon the assumption that humans don't do this sort of work alone, that where we fall short, God is the consistent moral force, the same God that did a job on Job, but that's for another time. We don't have that luxury. So the kind of hyper-optimism that we have, and from my vantage point, coming out of the Enlightenment moving forward, this assumption that human progress is somewhat inevitable isn't a good strategy. It seems to me we need a different approach. W.E.B. Du Bois taught us this and we ignored him, but perhaps we'll hear this from Camus. He's another one of my favorite thinkers, Albert Camus, this fantastic, fantastic figure. And here's the thing. It seems to me, for non-theists, there is no sense of guaranteed outcomes. And so we don't do justice work because we know it will produce anything. We do justice work because it's our last best option. It's what we can do. Not that it will produce any of the results we hope for, but it's what we can do. It's our ability to maximize our talents and our capacities for a greater good, outcomes we can't determine. Camus, in this short essay, describes this figure, Sisyphus. And this figure, Sisyphus, is being punished by the gods. And this punishment involves him having to roll this rock up a hill, knowing it's coming back down. And this perpetual activity without outcomes is supposed to break Sisyphus. Zeus and the others are certain of this, that this sort of labor without a guaranteed outcome, the ability to finally control that rock, will break Sisyphus. But Camus argues, no, this isn't what happens. That Sisyphus has awareness, lucidity. He understands the task and that it will never be completed. And for him, this is okay. The victory is in his ability to roll this hill and his awareness of his predicament. Not the resolution of it, but just the awareness of it, to know how he is occupying time and space and not be broken by it. And he ends the short essay with these words. One must imagine Sisyphus. Not that he is, not that he ought to be, but one must imagine Sisyphus happy. Camus talks in terms of kind of perpetual rebellion. Again, not the idea that our efforts will produce the kind of outcomes we want, because this thing called racial discrimination is so illogical, so irrational. It's just so embedded in the very fabric of our life together, we're not always aware of how it operates, right? And that is the genius of this system. It becomes the unspoken rule. You don't have to name it, it just is. And so we might not have the kind of victory we want, but Mu argues that there is something of value in this perpetual effort, the ability to say no, and to say no again, and to say no again to injustice. Not mindful of the outcomes, but comforted by the fact that you have used your capacities and your talents to try to make a difference, and leave it at that. We must imagine ourselves happy. One gets this also with Du Bois. Everything he tries in Souls of Black Folk doesn't produce the kind of outcomes that he is interested in, doesn't produce the kind of outcomes he's interested in, but he doesn't surrender, again, because there is something valuable in the effort. And finally, do your homework. If you are really concerned about racial justice, do your homework. And don't assume that every Black person that you encounter is responsible for teaching you on this subject. Do your homework. There are so many materials available online and in bookstores. Do some homework. Ignorance is not an excuse. In the same way that we would expect folks to be educated with respect to scientific developments, you should expect folks to be educated concerning these social structures. Learn about the topic. Know something about it. And through your knowing, demonstrate that you are about the business. You are serious about this. So I'm going to leave it at that, and perhaps we can chat for a few minutes. There's a few minutes left, yeah? All right. So maybe we can chat for a little bit.
Please. Thank you. That was very enlightening. And I really, my name is Hunter Adams, and I appreciate your directness, your making it very plain. I would just like to add, maybe, I don't know how many people in this room have read Justice Roger B. Taney's Dred Scott decision. If you haven't read it, if you are a lawyer, you probably are required to read it. I would say go online and read Chief Justice Roger E. Taney's 1857 Dred Scott decision. He gives the answer to everything that you're talking about. The reason for this is because African descended Americans, well, weren't Americans then, were never brought to this country to be a part of the body politic. Judge A. Leon Higginbotham, in his book, A Matter of Color, lists, starting in 1681, the criminalization process of Black people. And it's never stopped. It's never stopped. So I would suggest for those who need more information, hopefully that may inspire you. And it's difficult reading, by the way. When you read what Dred Scott's, what the Chief Justice of the United States Supreme Court said about African people, and there's many others, by the way, it requires work. This is part of the homework that you suggest. And it's difficult because we've been socialized against each other. Because the Bacon Rebellion, when that happened, it was Irish, it was Anglos, and it was African servants who came together to try to overthrow the plantation system. But it failed. And so we can do that again, I believe. Thank you very much.
Thank you. I'm not sure if you read it. I read a fascinating book called The Invention of White People. Have you heard of that book? Have you read it? And if you have, do you have any comments on that?
I've only skimmed it. And so I have PhD students who do work in whiteness studies, but I don't. But I would say that, like, blackness is a social construct, that the category of whiteness is also a social construct, but again, developed in opposition to. And you get some sense of how this works. There's another book, How the Irish Became White. Right? Here's another despised population, not because of skin color, but other markers of difference that are demonized. But how do they get out of this cycle? In part, through the adaptation of a language that helped them to demonize another population, black people. So there are ways in which whiteness shifts. It can be earned, it can be bartered.
When I deal with people individually, I make every effort to treat everybody equitably, and that includes being in some sense gender blind and blind to racial overtones or signals and cues and whatnot. And yet, even though I try personally to interact with people in that way, I have some acquaintances that are conservative, that still propagate some myths about racism in America, and that there is no imbalance in our criminal justice system, that, you know, black people commit more crimes on average than white people, etc. So I find myself in this dual position of really striving to treat everybody as just a human being, and on the other hand, having to deal with the obvious repercussions of institutionalized racism. And I wonder what your advice is for keeping that kind of dispassionate humanism on the one hand, but being aware of social injustices on the other. How can you have both attitudes at the same time and not recognize that a person you may be speaking to has been deeply affected by some of the prejudices that you're sort of abstractly aware of?
Yeah, thank you. You, without knowing it, you pressed one of my buttons. Just the idea of colorblindness bothers me, right? Because it positions difference in a way that I'm uncomfortable with, that I dislike. It positions difference as a problem to solve, as opposed to understanding difference, diversity as an opportunity. And so it is perfectly acceptable. In fact, I would expect you to see me and see a black man, right? Not just a human, but to see me and see a black man. But here's what I'm asking you: add to that, not problematize my blackness, not wish it away, right? Certainly not ignore it, but recognize that difference isn't a problem to solve. It's an opportunity. It's an opportunity. And so for me, this the stance of colorblindness really doesn't allow us to fully challenge normative stance. It allows it to remain static. Because I'm just hard-pressed how I could say, right, and we'll flip this a bit. I'm not quite certain how I could, on one hand, challenge gender bias, and on the other say, you know, when I see you, I don't see a bit. It allows me to maintain my normativity by wiping out their difference. as opposed to recognizing it, embracing it, and allowing it to challenge, right? And here's another thing that we need to be mindful of. It seems to me, with respect to social justice writ large, it really doesn't matter whether you're talking about gender, sexuality, whether you're talking about age, class, whatever, that we have to anticipate discomfort. If you are interested in justice work and that effort doesn't render you uncomfortable, then you're doing it wrong. Right? Because we're talking about forcing populations to give up privilege. So if I'm really concerned with gender justice, there's something about this work that ought to render me uncomfortable because it challenges me to surrender privilege. Soft and hard forms of privilege. Why wouldn't that be hard? Why wouldn't that be uncomfortable? Why wouldn't that be on some level painful? That we cannot do justice work and remain comfortable. Comfort is the status quo.
One little aside and one question. The Camus quote made me think of a quote from a film director that I like. He was, I can't remember it exactly, but he said something to the tune of religious people believe in a God that they have no evidence for, whereas humanists believe in something they have evidence, a lot of evidence that they're not working very well at it. So humanists are really the true believers. Something like that. But the basic question is on the gaining of knowledge. I try to read the papers and I read up on everything, but still I get surprised on a fairly regular basis. The speaker last night, I felt like asking for her for her book list because about half the books I never heard of. And I was just thinking of the other time when I was reading an article on the Black Panther, and they came up with this line that you couldn't have a movie starring all blacks because it wouldn't sell overseas internationally. And that was a total head scratcher for me. I have no idea why anybody would come up with that thought, and I assume it was some sort of odd racist statement, but it's, you get that sort of thing sinking in your brain all the time, so it's like, what am I trying to say? How is it to keep up with the knowledge when everything surprises you on a fairly regular basis? Anyway.
It seems to me, right, and I'm generalizing, that non-theists pride themselves on being critically engaged, being critical thinkers, right, interrogating. And so one interrogates this information. Again, there are so many sources. My contact African Americans for Humanism, right? There's so many sources, so many materials to make use of beyond newspapers and Facebook posts, right? There are tremendous materials to engage and address those materials with the same sort of rigor you would apply to a text on some dimension of science. So read W.E.B. Du Bois with the same sort of passion and energy you read Richard Dawkins.
Hi.
Hey.
So it seems to me that Ta-Nehisi Coates has brought some of the perspectives that you're talking about to the mainstream in a way that hadn't been there before. Particularly depressing black atheism. The black atheism that doesn't have the social justice guarantee that we're heading towards this golden land that's guaranteed by our enlightenment progress kind of thing. Am I misrepresenting this perspective?
Yeah, we would disagree on that a bit.
All right. Well, it seems that from what I've seen, there's been a long trend in some black academic fields that includes an atheistic or existentialist or even nihilistic view that we do this work, but we're not guaranteed to win. And that's often in contrast to the sort of Martin Luther King perspective that we're doing this and we are guaranteed to win. Do you think what I've seen mostly in social justice activism is a kind of confidence that we're on the right side and we will win? Do you think that the black atheist existentialist perspective therefore undercuts social justice activism in ways? Or do you think that it empowers us by recognizing that even if we're struggling, we should expect that it's hard, we should expect that we won't necessarily succeed, but we should take pride and gain happiness from being able to do this work because it gives us meaning?
A couple of points on which I would disagree. One, Coates, his book rides the coattails of Richard Wright, right? So no, he's not the first to provide this sort of black existentialist take. I would reject the idea that it's nihilistic. It certainly isn't. That it has a good sense of the tragic comic quality of life, but it is not nihilistic, right? He doesn't surrender, just recognize that this struggle is perpetual. So it seems to me that there's a long history of this sort of thought that is lodged in the Harlem Renaissance, but not limited to the Harlem Renaissance. And so we have a more recent take on that posture towards the world in Coates, but it's long standing. I would argue it's the complete opposite, that this sort of, and I would call it a measured realism, that this sort of measured realism concerning our efforts is the way to go. This unjustifiably optimistic stance undercuts and damages effort. Because I don't know how long one can maintain a kind of energy that doesn't produce the outcome. So what we end up with are people surprised and shocked by racial violence in the United States. Those cops were not convicted. Oh my goodness, how can this be? Look at the history, right? Just look at how race has developed in the United States. It seems to me the challenge is this, to do the work because we can do the work without the assumption that this work isn't of value if it doesn't produce this thing we want. The effort itself, perhaps the effort itself is the victory. The ability to, in a sustained manner, say no to injustice, that's the win.
Could you speak about tribalism? And I say that in the sense that evolutionary psychologists, in looking at the list of human traits and developing in recent history wonderful new knowledge, getting at the question of what we are, you know, really, what is human nature? On the plus side, we have compassion. You can see this in babies. We have a strong sense of fairness. You can see that even in monkeys. We enjoy cooperating with others and helping others. This is really the glue that holds social animal society together. On the negative side, we seem to have tribalism. Could you speak to that?
The language of tribalism is not without context, right? It's charged in a particular way. So you'd have to give me a sense of how you understand that as charged. I find it not problematic at all for blacks, for example, to understand that there's a certain level of comfort, a certain level of security within the context of the group, right? That is perfectly acceptable. But as soon as we begin to fixate on why all the color kids are sitting together in the cafeteria, we need to recognize what the white kids are doing, right? And so there's a sense in which it is only problematic when groups held suspect understand the value of their time together. But otherwise, not so much. I don't share your optimistic read. I would be more along the lines with, if you're familiar with him, William James. And in Varieties of Religious Experience, he argues there are really two types of folks, that there are the healthy-minded and the sick souls. The healthy-minded go through life and they see all of the value, all of the positive developments, and they refuse to see the animosity, the pain, the despair, and the trauma. The sick soul, which is actually the person he prefers, right? This is his take. This is the way he understands we ought to be moving, refuses to dismiss the tragedy, the drama, the pain, the misery, the suffering in human life. That is my stance. Right? So that is the vantage point that I'm most comfortable with and the one I would want to champion, that we have to be ever mindful of the pain and misery, the suffering that marks our lives together. So some of these traits that you speak of, I'm hard-pressed to understand in the context of this sort of violent racial disregard. Compassion, I don't see. And again, what I was trying to get at is, from my vantage point, it is a problematic. The concept is used in a way that is problematic. That, from my vantage point, it often is used to undermine the capacity of to feel comfortable with themselves.
All right, we have time for one more question.
Is there someone else with a mic? Oh, it's me. Okay. My question is, essentially, to what degree do you think that the system of racism in the United States is a facet of class struggle and the system of capitalism? And I mean that in the sense that clearly certain aspects of the system of racism are very closely tied to, you know, capitalism and, you know, ways in which the, you know, ultra rich, the ruling class, use this as a tool to essentially divide different facets of the working class along racial lines, you know, to essentially hold on to their power. So to what extent do you think that, like, the way that racism maintains itself is sort of explained within this context of class struggle in the system of capitalism, or to what extent do you think it's also something really different going on?
Yeah, I would say this, that oppression is web-like in nature. So my argument would be class discrimination, racial discrimination, gender bias, et cetera, they are interconnected. They feed off of each other, but there's still an element of each that cannot be explained by simply looking at that whole. That there are ways in which racial disregard functions in the United States that cannot be fully captured with respect to class analysis or class critique. Right? So I would argue you need Marx and more. You would need Marx and more.
Awesome. That's all the time we have for questions. We return at 3:00. Thank you, Anthony.
Thank you.